Hello, Twins fans. This is John Swole with TwinsTrivia.com, and I would like to welcome you to still another interview with a player from the Twins' wonderful past. Today we have the honor and pleasure of speaking with former Twins infielder Jerry Slim Kendall. Jerry played in the big leagues with the Cubs, Indians, and the Twins between 1956 and 1965. After leaving pro ball, Kendall went into collegiate coaching and coached at the University of Arizona from 1973 to 1996, where he won 860 games and three College World Series national championships. So without further ado, here's Jerry Kendall. Jerry, you were born and grew up in St. Paul, where you attended Washington High School. Can you tell us a little about growing up in St. Paul and your high school sports career?
Well, I'm so grateful, John, to have been born to a terrific family. My mom and dad, we're a very blue-collar family. I'm the oldest of three boys, and dad worked two jobs, one with the Great Northern Railroad. 45 years he put in on the railroad.
Wow.
And then he had to hold a second job in the mornings because my mother was ill with multiple sclerosis and was in a wheelchair. So it was a hand-to-mouth kind of life, but Dad was faithful and strong and godly, and we grew up in a great situation as far as love in the home. We first of all lived down in near Dale and Fuller, which was in a roading neighborhood, but I didn't know that. We had good friends, good pals around the neighborhood, and we would play our baseball and football and basketball in the street and so on. But it was a wonderful childhood. Went on to Washington High School then, and would like to have played football, but my dad said no. Because he thought I had some future in baseball, and he didn't want me to get injured. And it was a wise decision. But I did play baseball and basketball at Washington High, and I was blessed, John, with great coaches and great adults in my life, besides my dad, who encouraged me in the right way. They did. I'm talking about Fritz Clark, my American Legion coach, and Harry Nelson, the baseball and basketball coach at Washington, and a host of others who made sure I did the right thing and had high standards for my behavior as well as my practices and my fundamentals in those two sports, baseball and basketball. So I look back on those days at Washington High and growing up in St. Paul with a great deal of fondness. And I miss it. I've been here in Arizona 38 years, so I do get back, of course, to the Twin Cities, and we still have lots of family there and loved ones. But I miss Minnesota, if you can imagine that. A baseball coach saying he misses Minnesota rather than Arizona. However, I'm very, very happy here and grateful for the opportunity to have coached here.
Yeah, that St. Paul area, you know, brought a lot of Major League Baseball players in.
Indeed, and great college athletes too. Washington High School on Rice Street in St. Paul was known as a tough neighborhood, and it was very ethnic, and but very upright also. And it was a good education at Washington High, and also my love for sports was very well satisfied there.
You went on to attend the University of Minnesota. Did you go on a via scholarship?
Yes, I received a basketball scholarship, but I look back on it now and realize there was something of a conspiracy there and an agreement between Ozzie Cowles, the basketball coach, and Dick Siebert, the baseball coach. I liked to play basketball. I was no great shakes, but I did play well enough that I could play on the Gopher team, and it wasn't a full ride, John. I got a partial tuition fees and books, and then I was able to play both sports and encouraged to play both sports, but I think Dick Siebert, and I speak with great reverence about Dick, he is my... Well, I learned all my baseball from Dick Siebert. To this day, I still use the principles and coaching philosophy said, how's that sound? Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know that at the time, but that's, I think, how it came down. I'm very grateful to both of those coaches, Ozzie Cowles and Dick Siebert.
That worked out pretty well for you. And you mentioned Dick Siebert. You played for the Gophers, I believe, in 55 and 56, and in your final year you won the Collegiate World Series under Coach Dick Siebert. What can you share about that experience with us?
Well, it was a dream come true for all of us. We knew about the College World Series, and that was the pinnacle, the promised land, if you will, Omaha, Nebraska, and the College World Series for college baseball players and coaches. And I was, as a freshman in 1953 and 54, we were ineligible at that time. Do you remember the rule, John, in the NCAA, freshmen were ineligible for varsity competition. So we played our freshman team. And then as a sophomore and junior, I played shortstop for Dick Siebert. And my sophomore year was, I thought, not very well. I was surprised he gave me the job because I didn't hit well. But he saw some future for me, and Dick stayed with me. And we had a good team in 1955, but we didn't advance to the playoffs. Well, 1956, it all came together, John, with great pitching and an outstanding infield and an offense. We could win with the bat, or we could win with the pitching. And Dick was the master guide for all that, our head coach, and we went all the way to win the national championship with a final victory in the championship game, ironically, against the University of Arizona. And we won that, and we were the national champions. But let me give you a couple names off of that team that went on to do really outstanding things. The third baseman on my right was Jack McCartan, a terrific baseball player, but more than that, he was a great goaltender in hockey. Yeah. And he went on to lead the USA team to the gold medal in 1960, I believe it was, as the goaltender. Our best pitcher, we had a group of really good pitchers, but the one that really stepped out and led the way was Jerry Thomas. And Jerry, from St. Thomas Academy in St. Paul, came to the university, and he was the MVP at the College World Series. He was a very good pitcher and a great competitor and a good hitter. We didn't use a DH in those days. In right field, we had Shorty Cochran, who was an outstanding football player for the Gophers. And at second base, my partner there was Gene Martin, who went on to play some minor league ball, but he made his mark as a sculptor and an artist. And he's still doing these beautiful sculptures, and I think it's out in Wyoming where he has a cabin up in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. An interesting guy from South High in Minneapolis, and he was a great second baseman. Behind the plate, who was behind the plate? I've forgotten. Forgive me. Left field was Bill Horning, our captain, and Bill was a leader on the field and a great inspiration to us. He had come out of the service at that time. It was okay in the NCAA eligibility rules, John, where a player could have spent 2 years or more in the service and then come back and have eligibility. And we had at least three guys. Bill Horning, our captain, was one of them. Shorty Cochran came back out of the service. And Doug Gillen, one of our first basemen, all were service returnees.
Wow.
So we had a team of maturity and also a team of great drive and determination. And it was one of the best teams I've ever played on.
Sounded like it was a lot of fun.
It was, and I value those friendships to this day.
Dick Siebert had a remarkable coaching career. What was it like to play for him?
Well, he was a stickler for fundamentals, John. And I didn't realize or appreciate at the time, doing those drills over and over and over again, the proper way to field, the proper way to throw. And I thought that was pretty much little league stuff. job. We should have known that when we got there. But he took nothing for granted, and he started at the basics, you know, run, throw, hit, and field. And he was literally the only coach for much of the time. His assistant coach for a long time was Glenn Gostick. And Glenn knew baseball as well as anybody I've ever come across. But he was also the assistant trainer for the university Golden Gophers. And so Dick was oftentimes all alone coaching every position. And he demanded that we know the fundamentals and the proper techniques for, in my case, it was shortstop and fielding and throwing and hitting. So he was a great teacher. He was rather gruff at times. He didn't have a whole lot of patience, but believe me, we listened hard and we tried very much to satisfy him because we admired him so. He is a former big leaguer, played with the St. Louis Cardinals and the Philadelphia Athletics under Connie Mack. So he knew the game, and he worked extremely hard. I know this, and I remember this, John. I'd like to mention it. He had every practice outlined and on the board, and what was expected of us before we got to the field. And for January, February, and half of March, we were in the field house over at the university. The field house is still standing.
Yeah.
And it was a dirt floor, and the track team held practices there, and the baseball team. And so he would have every moment accounted for on a practice plan. And then we knew exactly what was expected of us.
Mm-hmm.
And we could go from station to station and drill to drill and do our thing. And then Dick could move on to another position, or he practiced so well organized that he covered it all. Now, fast forward, after I was released by the Twins in 1966, then I went to the university as assistant basketball coach under John Cundlin. I needed a job. And the university, Marsh Ryman, the athletic director, was very gracious to put me on the staff as assistant basketball coach. And then I did a lot of other things. I taught some classes and was kind of I did whatever Marsh asked.
Sure.
And so the basketball coaching for several years, and then I became assistant baseball coach under Dick. And I did both for a year, and that was an impossible job, assistant basketball coach and assistant baseball, because I didn't have any time, and I was working on my master's degree at that time also. But then I saw up close and personal how well Dick planned his practices, and he would spend hours away from the office at home in Edina, where he lived, making sure that every T was crossed and every I was dotted for the baseball practice plans every day. And I thought to myself, gosh, if I ever get to be head coach, I'm not going to take all that time. I'm not going to spend all that time doing that. That's too much. Well, when I got the head job here in 1972, head baseball coach at the University of Arizona, I found that I did it exactly like Dick.
Wow.
And I'm so glad that he taught me organization. He taught me the value of fundamentals, and he taught me the value of competitiveness. You had to be tough to play under Dick, because he did not tolerate errors or doing things other than his way. But all those things morphed together when I became a head coach, and I'm so grateful for all he taught to me.
That's great. After your 1956 championship and All-American season with the Gophers, you signed with the Chicago Cubs for a bonus that made you one of the so-called bonus babies.
Yes, and I signed with the Cubs after my junior year, and that was the year we won the national championship, 1956. And the bonus rule was in effect that any player that got more than $4,000 to sign his contract had to spend 2 years on the big league roster. And that was an attempt by baseball to provide equity in getting every team. There were 16 teams at that time, of course, 8 in the National League, 8 in the American League. And the wealthier teams, like the Cardinals, like the Yankees, and at that time the amended the rule, John, after the 1957 season, the bonus rule, and I went right to the minor leagues, to Double A ball, the Cubs Farm Club at Fort Worth, Texas. And I played second base then. And that was the Cubs' plan for me, because I wasn't going to beat out Ernie Banks, let's face it. And so they sent me down to Fort Worth in the Texas League, and I played every game, every inning at second base. And I was back there in 1959 at Fort Worth, and now we were in the American Association. We had moved up to AAA, and I played second base all that season as well. So by the time in 1960, when I was still property of the Cubs, of course, and I made the club in spring training and played second base in 1960 and 61, and thereafter I was a second baseman in the big leagues.
Okay. That's interesting about that bonus rule. How do you think that bonus rule impacted your baseball career?
Well, I think it set me back a little bit. Mm-hmm. I was grateful for the money. It was a windfall for the family. And I was grateful to get the experience of big league baseball. But it set me back, I think, in my development because I wasn't able to play all that much. I think in 1957 I might have had, oh gosh, you'd have to look it up. I maybe had 180 at-bats. 1956 I think I had only 50. I was a bench warmer, and that held back my development. And but I wouldn't want it any differently, John. I believe God's hand was on me way back then, and directed what was happening in my life, as long as I was obedient as a Christian, mm-hmm. obedient to the Scripture, and obedient to what's expected of a follower of Christ. But anyway, I wouldn't have changed it at all. And then when I got down to the minor leagues, I could play every day, and I really began to improve enough to come back and play in the major leagues.
And you mentioned the money. It's been reported that you signed for about $50,000. Is that accurate?
Well, I'll tell you exactly how it was. It was a 3-year contract that I signed. And it was for a $32,000 bonus, but it included, it bumped up to $50,000 when you took into account the minimum salary in the big leagues at that time was $6,000. Mm-hmm. So I had a 3-year contract for $6,000, that's $18,000 obviously, and a bonus of $32,000 for a package of $50,000. Yeah, that was accurate.
Okay. And that was pretty nice money back then, for sure.
Oh, it sure was. That, my father could get rid of it, the old jalopy that he'd been driving for so many years, and I was so grateful to be able to provide that for Mom and Dad.
Well, that's nice. So one day after you signed your first contract, you found yourself in the big leagues in a Chicago uniform. What did the rest of the... How did the team accept somebody like yourself?
Well, that's interesting, John. There weren't many bonus players at that time, but they were on big league rosters and had to stay there, and most of us were not ready to play in the big leagues, and so there was some resentment. I signed at 12 noon on the 30th of June in our living room at home. General manager Whit Matthews was there, and the scout that signed me, Vidi Himsel. Well, then I had to report the next morning.
Wow.
And Vidi Himsel and I, he stayed at the hotel, of course, that night, and then met me at the airport, and we flew to Chicago on the early flight, and there I was for a doubleheader with the St. Louis Cardinals. No, I'm sorry, the Milwaukee Braves. It was with the Braves.
Okay.
And I wondered, where am I? What am I doing here?
Things change so quickly.
Yeah, it was a dramatic change. But it was my dream come true. I wanted desperately to play in the major leagues, and there I was sitting on the bench. But there was some resentment among the other players that a bonus player came in without any experience.
Sure.
In pro ball, and with money, I was grateful to get what I got, but there were some guys that got he was a utility infielder, had tried for years to get to the major leagues, and there he was, 25th man on the roster, and here comes a bonus player, and he goes back to the minor leagues. And he was a popular player on the team, and I understand that. I understand that there was some feeling about bonus players, and to me in particular. However, less than 2 weeks later, Mo Drabowski signed a bonus contract with the Cubs, and he joined me as a bonus player. Already there, when I reported on July 1st, 1956, was Don Kaiser, a bonus pitcher from Oklahoma. So there were three of us on the big league roster then. And Don Kaiser was a pretty good pitcher, and he got his time on the mound. And Mo Drabowski, they put him right in as a starter. He was at Trinity University in Hartford, Connecticut, so he was older. Mo and myself were like 21, 22 years old when we signed. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't that we were right out of high school. Don Kaiser came right out of high school. But anyway, your question about how was the feeling among my teammates, I had to just shut up and do my stay out of trouble.
Sure.
But in time, all that changed, mm-hmm. and I was accepted as a member of the team.
Great. The first few games you appeared in, you came in mainly as a pinch runner, but after a few games, you had your first hit, and I think it was a single off of Lindy McDaniel. What do you remember
about? You've done your research, John.
What do you remember about that hit?
Oh, yes, I do remember. Excuse me. I had been in the game, several of them, leading up to that, as a pinch runner. But then I came to the ballpark, and I think it was probably like August 1st, mm-hmm. and Ernie Banks was in the training room with his hand all puffed up. He had gotten an infection in his hand, and he couldn't play. And suddenly I'm starting in that shortstop in place of Ernie Banks. And I played for 2 weeks until he got well again. And surprisingly, I did fine defensively, and I didn't hit much, but I did get my first hit in a game against the Cardinals, against Lindy McDaniel, who, by the way, was also a bonus player, and he was pitching for the Cardinals. And I remember the ground ball in the hole in the left field, and at that time, you didn't ask for the ball, you know, as a memento.
Uh-huh.
You didn't do that. Now they bring it to you at
sure.
base, you know, your first base hit. If I had asked, I didn't even think to ask for it, no. You would, but if I had, I'd have been laughed out of the ballpark by the other players.
Wow. Things are a little different.
Yeah, a little different. And but I do remember, I thought for a time after that hit, of course, I floated down to first base, and I'm so grateful finally got my first hit. And it might have been Stan Musial playing first base. If it wasn't him, it was Bill White. And I don't remember for sure, but he said, "First hit, kid?" Whoever it was, Musial or White.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Yeah, it is. My first hit." He said, "Well, I think there are going to be many more. Nice going, young man." You know, gave me a word of encouragement down there.
That's nice.
And I really appreciated that a lot.
That's really nice. Like you mentioned earlier, you only played in like 32 games in 56 and 72 games in 57. Was that frustrating to you to spend so much time on the bench when you were, you know, coming out of college and you were, you know, one of the star players?
Oh, yes, it was frustrating. And I had never sat on the bench before in high school or college or Legion ball. But I knew my place, John, and I listened carefully and tried to do the things that Dick Siebert had taught me when I did get on the field, and I took a lot of batting practice. I was really working hard to try to earn my place on the team. And although I didn't hit, I was overpowered by the pitchers, as a matter of fact. Facing Sandy Koufax and Don Drysdale and Bob Gibson, my goodness, it was... I was way over my head.
They were some pitchers, that's for sure.
Yeah, they sure were. They were terrific, all of them.
You spent, I think, pretty much all of 1958 in the minors, but you were called up in September, and then you spent all of 59 in AAA, and you had a chance to play against the Millers and the Saints, I believe, that season. Do you remember
that? Yes, the American Association had been realigned in 1959, and both Dallas, Texas, and Fort Worth, Texas, came into the association as new franchises. And so that meant coming home to play against the Saints and the Millers. And I got to play against the Saints in St. Lexington Park, the historical ballpark there that I had I'd been a regular there as a boy watching the Saints. And at that time, the Millers were playing in the new Metropolitan Stadium. It wasn't completed.
Yep.
The field was in, the dugouts, but the stands were still being erected. And it was kind of weird. And we, the Fort Worth Cats, won the Southern Division of the American Association. And the Millers won the Northern Division. And we had a 5-game playoff, if I remember rightly, to see who would be the American Association champion and go on to the Little World Series against the Havana Sugar Kings. They were the champion of the International League. Way back then, you may remember, John, that the Little World Series came in October, the champion of the American Association and the champion of the International League played a 7-game series for the Little World Series. Well, we went right down to the 5th game against the Millers, and we played we had each won 2 games, and the winner would go on to Havana the next day, because there had been some delays in our getting the series finished because of rain. And so we were going to play no matter what the weather was, and we did. We played in a rainstorm at Metropolitan Stadium. And the Millers won that game in the late innings on a little ground ball that got between the first baseman and me, the second baseman, in the rain. Both of us slipped and fell almost as we tried to get to the ball, but the winning run scored for the Millers. Base hit to right. And they went on to play the Havana Sugar Kings, and we went home.
That's baseball, I guess. You know, it's
I remember very well. Excuse me, John, for interrupting. Yeah. Just another little footnote on that game. The general manager of the Millers was George Brophy. Now, he's rather an icon in Minnesota baseball, and he was insistent that we play that game. We had to get it in because the Little World Series would have pointed out. Mm-hmm. And thereafter, every time I saw George for the rest of his life and my life, because he stayed in baseball, and I was in baseball, of course, as a player and then as a college coach, and I'd bump into George a number of times, and we'd review that game, and I'd say, George, you were out of your mind to make us play that game in the rain. And then he would giggle and laugh and said, well, that's the second baseman of the losing team speaking.
That's a great line.
Yeah.
In the early part of 1960, you were called up by the Cubs, and you would kind of stay in the big leagues from that point forward. With a couple of seasons in the minors behind you, were you now ready to play in the major leagues?
Yes, I was. I was sent down in 1960 at spring training by the Cubs in Mesa, Arizona. I went back to AAA. This time it was to the Houston Buffaloes. And I had played okay in spring training, but the Cubs thought that I needed a little more seasoning. So I went to Houston, again as a second baseman. And by the way, I played for the manager in Houston was Enos Slaughter, of Gas House Gang fame. And the general manager of the Houston Buffaloes was Marty Marion, the great shortstop for the Cardinals for so many years, who was my hero as a youngster because he was tall and skinny, like I was tall and skinny.
Yeah.
And he was my general manager there, and Enos Slaughter was our manager on the field. Well, I was only there about 3 weeks, and then the Cubs called me back up. But it was very interesting to get to know Enid Slaughter and Marty Marion in that way. They were both heroes of the 30s and 40s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. After the 1961 season, you were told that Ernie Banks is going to be moved to first base and that you were going to be the regular Cubs shortstop. What did you think about that?
Well, I've been playing a lot of second base in 1961 because Ernie was very durable. And believe me, you don't take Ernie Banks out of the lineup for some youngster. But I did play, I shared second base with Don Zimmer in 1960 and 61. But you're right. When at the end of the season, the Cubs front office, I'm trying to remember, it wasn't Whit Matthews at that time, it was somebody else, and the manager was Lou Boudreau. No, that was the college coaches in 61. Do you remember that? Uh-huh. Do you remember that the Cubs did not have a manager in 1961 as such?
Oh, they rotated it or had a group?
Yeah.
Okay.
We had 12 men identified as coaches, and one of them would evolve into the head coach and be the leader of the team. The principal behind it was Mr. Wrigley, a very kind and generous owner, Philip K. Wrigley, of the Cubs. Just, it hurt him to fire managers. And rather than do that, he came up with the idea that we'll not have a manager, we'll have 12 coaches. Now, six of those coaches, and I don't know how they appointed them as such, but six of those coaches would rotate throughout spring training of 1961. Well, to tell the truth, in principle, it was a noble idea, but it didn't work. It didn't work. We needed one person consistently that was the manager, the hitman, the one from whom we took the final orders. Well, we went through the 61 season with that in place, and a number, I think there were probably five different head coaches that took over. You see, if we weren't winning under one head coach, then they just rotate him out of there. He wasn't fired. He would resume his place as one of the coaches in the minor leagues or on the big league staff. So I believe we had five head coaches: Harry Kraft, Vidi Himsel, Elvin Tappy.
I think Lou Klein was the
other. Lou Klein, and I played for him in the minor leagues. He was my manager in Fort Worth for 2 years, and a good manager, by the way. So it failed, but they did that for another year in 1962, but by this time I was in Cleveland. But let's go back to your comment. I was told at the end of the 61 season that I was going to be given the shortstop job in spring training. They were going to move Ernie Banks over to first base. Well, I was absolutely ecstatic. Although I played second base for the better part of 2 years, more than 2 years, in the minor leagues, I really loved shortstop. So I came home for the winter, went back to school at the University of Minnesota, and in the sporting news one day, on the way to school, I rode a bike to school, by the way, from our home in St. Anthony Village, because we only had one car. And my late wife, Georgia, needed that, because by that time we had two children.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I rode my bike, I stopped at a newsstand, and picked up the sporting news, the baseball paper. And at that time, it was all baseball.
Yeah.
Now the sporting news is still a good buy for everybody, but it has hockey, football, basketball, pro sports in it. Anyway, there's one of the lead articles, Kindle to shortstop, Banks to first base, and a long article by one of the Chicago writers. Well, again, I felt so good about it and was already practicing with the Gophers in fall baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Under Dick Siebert, I was allowed to practice with him. And I came home that very night after class and after working out, and my wife, Georgia, said, "Say, there's a long-distance call for you from Gabe Paul, the general manager of the Cleveland Indians." And I thought, what in the world? Well, there's only one thing I knew right away. I'd been traded. Why is Gabe Paul calling? I didn't even know Gabe Paul. But I returned the call, and yes, that's what happened. The Cubs had traded me to Cleveland for a pitcher, Bobby Locke.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Cleveland for the 62, 63, and 64 I loved my time in Cleveland because in 1962, John, I played every game, every inning of every game, with the exception of six games, I believe it was, when my mother died back in St. Paul, and I came home in August for that funeral and to be with the family. But other than that, I played every day, and that was a wonderful season because I got to play and I did pretty well.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say you hit 13 home runs that year.
Yes, I did, and I played good defensively. I felt really good about coming back to spring training in 63. We had a new manager, Bertie Tebbets, in 63, but I was the incumbent, and I hurt my back in spring training. And I was out of the lineup for, I was in the training room for about 10 days getting that back well, and it did get well, and I was perfectly fine. But by that time, Bertie had settled on another second baseman, and it was the young guy, Brown. Dick Brown's brother. I'm sorry. A very good player. So he started at second base when the 63 season began, and I was a utility man. I played quite a bit in 63, but I was more a utility man than a starter. And in 64, that was the same situation, mostly utility, but got some good at-bats and played his streaks. And then I was traded to the Twins.
Hey, that was in June of 64. You're part of a three-team trade, I think, the Indians, the Angels, and you ended up in your home state.
Yeah, and I was so pleased and excited because by that time, in 1964, we had three children, my late wife Georgia and myself. We had three children, and she was expecting our fourth to be born in July. And so I believe, again, it was the hand of God that orchestrated the move, and I was traded to the Twins, and I could be home for the birth of our fourth child, Martha.
Well, that was pretty nice.
Yeah, and Sam Mealy was a manager, and boy, we had some great guys on the team, and again, I was pretty much utility, and then in 65, we went independent, so it all came together.
Yeah, and in that 65 season, you were pretty much the regular second baseman until you got hurt, and then I think Frank Quilisi was called up, and you lost some playing time.
Yes, and that was the right thing. I was wiped out at second base in Comiskey Park twice in the same game.
Ooh.
And I couldn't play. I didn't go on the disabled list, but I was out of the lineup for probably 2 weeks again. And Frank was called up from Denver, AAA club for the Twins. And this was probably August. Oh, I'm not sure. Maybe first part of August.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank Carey played great when he came up, and he played second base the rest of the way, and that was the right move by Sam Mealy. There was no reason to take Frank out of the lineup. I was well by that time. I could have played, and I played some defensive late inning kind of things, and pinch hit some, and played a little bit of third base, and so on. But Frank played so well, and he played second base right through the World Series. Yes. And he played great.
And you never got a chance?
I never played in the World Series. I was in uniform, and I was able to play. I was well. But, like I say, Fasoli Orsais was playing shortstop, and he was having the MVP season in the American League by that time. So the two positions, short and second, were well manned by Quilisi at second and by Fasoli Orsais at shortstop right through the World Series. And that, I guess, was my biggest disappointment in baseball, is I didn't get to play in the World Series.
Yeah, so, you know, you're right there, and not to be able to play has got to be really tough.
Yeah.
Were you awarded a World Series share and a ring, or how did that work?
Yes, I got a full share. The Dodgers beat us in seven games, as you recall.
Yep.
And that was, again, a great thrill for all of us on the Twins team. But they prevailed behind Sandy Koufax in the seventh game.
Sure. After spring training in 1966, Calvin Griffith called you into his office, and I think basically he released you, but he did ask if you would consider going to the minors, which you turned down.
Yes, I did. Well, by that time, I had put in nearly 8 years in the major league uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And he had made a trade with Boston. Dick Stigman, my close personal friend on the team, had been traded to Boston for the second baseman. Oh, what is his name? In that trade, I forgot, who came over to our club for Dick Stigman. But that made me expendable, and Calvin called me in, and he said, here's the situation. Both you and the other guy, I can't remember his name, and Frank was still in uniform, too, of course, and he was the incumbent second baseman. But Frank Rosie. But here's how Calvin put it. He said, neither one of you two guys can hit, so I can't keep both of you, and so I'm going to release you. And you can we'll find a place for you in AAA ball. We'd love you to go down to, I think it was still Denver at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can make a deal for yourself. And I really didn't pause at that point. I said, well, Calvin, give me my release. I'll try to hook on with some other team. But I don't want to go back to the minor leagues. And by that time, I was, 32, 33 years old. And so I did. I went home, and I tried to find a place. I made calls to three teams, but this was at the deadline. I was released just shortly before opening day. And again, another great disappointment. It's kind of funny. But I got released, and we were 2 days later going to pack up and close up spring training in Orlando and go to Houston for a three-game series, exhibition series, before the season started. And that was the chance to play in this fantastic, unique Astrodome.
Yep.
Indoor baseball. Nobody had ever heard of indoor baseball before that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking forward to playing inside in this crazy Astrodome. Well, that was a disappointment, too, and I didn't get to do that. But when I got home to Minneapolis, Georgia and I sat down, and we prayed together. And as I say, we had four children by that time. And we decided if I could find a job with any one of three teams, that would be, I would do that. So I called the Cleveland Indians, where I had been very happy under Gabe Paul, who was a terrific general manager. And he said, no, Jerry, we're trying to cut down on the roster. We can't add anybody because there had to be 25 men at opening day. And also I called Bill Rigney, who was with the was he with the Angels? I called the Angels, but I think it was Bill Rigney. I got a hold of him, the manager, whom I had known from his days as a Minneapolis Miller when he played there.
Sure.
And he said the same thing. No, we don't have room on the roster. And I called the Chicago White Sox and asked if they could use it as a utility infielder. And all of them said, no, we just can't do it. We're filled up on the roster. So that was it. And my pro career, I shut down. I think I could have played more. I was healthy by that time, but my batting average did not measure up after 8 years in the major leagues. I was a good fielder, but I wasn't a good hitter. So, but that also was a turnabout and a wonderful occurrence in our life when I put that behind me. I was disappointed. I wanted to play. I thought I could continue to play, John, but it wasn't going to happen. So the university opened the doors for me. I mentioned that earlier in our interview, and I was hired as assistant basketball coach under John Kundla. Well, I had the reason I could do that is I had coached the freshman basketball team for 3 years before that, before I went to spring training, because I was still working on my degree and then the master's degree after that, and I did that voluntarily. Coach the freshman basketball team. So I could do that now as a full-time job. And that opened the doors for me.
You know, when you coached the university freshman basketball team, was that about the time that Lou Hudson was there?
Lou was on the varsity by that time.
Okay.
Lou and Archie Clark, two great players for basketball. And, yes, I scouted teams for John Cutler. I was a freshman basketball coach and his assistant. He only had one assistant. Can you imagine that?
Not
well, I take that back. There were two of us, George Hansen and I were the two assistants. George was the first assistant coach. I was the second. So he stayed on the bench, and he was at practice with John Cutler for the varsity, and I did the freshman, and I did the scouting, and I was on the bench for games. But anyway, Lou Hudson, yes, I know Lou. I remember him very well, and Archie Clark. They were on the varsity at that time.
Well, they were great players, and Lou Hudson's always my all-time favorite basketball player.
Well, that's good. Mine, too, but, well, I don't know if he's my very favorite, but I have great admiration for him. He did something I didn't think was possible. He continued to play in the Big Ten and play outstandingly with his right hand, his shooting hand, in a cast.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he could dribble with his left hand so well that he was a forward. He didn't play in the post, but he was responsible to make a lot of plays, you know, coming off screens with the ball or without the ball, get the ball, and shoot. Well, he couldn't shoot with his right hand because, except for the fingertips, they were in a cast because he had broken his thumb in practice.
Mm-hmm.
And he continued to score about 15, 18 points a game and play every minute. It was remarkable.
Yeah. He was a great shooter, but I think what amazed me back then, and I was, you know, in high school back then, what amazed me was that I was listening to a game, and we didn't get too many games on TV back then, and we didn't have a TV anyway, but you know, that he jumped up for a rebound and cut his head on the backboard.
That's a true story. He was a great leaper.
That was amazing to me.
Yeah, now if he hits his head on the backboard, you can imagine where his arms are.
Yeah.
Extended. He was way over the rim. He was a great leaper. And outstanding. Of course, he went on for a great NBA career, too,
sure,
with the Atlanta Hawks, I believe, mostly. So, boy, I'm having visions now of Lou Hudson playing basketball for the Gophers, and it was a treat to watch and be something of a coach, although I never coached him. I coached the freshman, remember.
And it sounds like the Gophers basketball team this year is going to be wonderful, too, so you'll have to keep an eye on them.
Oh, I'm a letterman, so I get all the mailings and from Tubby Smith and so on. So I'm pulling very hard for them. Yeah.
I have to ask you, Jerry, looking back on your big league career, why do you think you struggled so much hitting for average?
Well, I could not lay off the high fastball. I was an uppercutter. And, boy, I had every hitting coach that you can imagine on the three teams for which I played. I mean, good men, good hitting coaches, like Jim Lemon with the Twins, and good guys with the Indians and the Cubs. But I was a uppercutter, and I never could get my swing in a place where I was hitting the top half of the ball instead of missing the underneath or popping it up. And I continued to swing at the high fastball. And so all of the good teaching and coaching I had, none of those hitting coaches used me as an example. That's a final word on that.
As a baseball coach, if you had Jerry Kendall as a ball player, do you think you could have made him a more consistent hitter?
No, Kendall was just too stubborn. He wanted to swing at that high fastball. It looked so good. I was a low ball hitter, and I could handle the ball below my belt and down to the knees. But I continued to get in the hole by swinging at the high fastball or popping it up or, you know, fouling it off or missing it. And yes, if I were a coach and I had myself on the team, I would take him out of the game as soon as he hit a pop fly or struck out.
Wow. In 1973, you became head coach at the University of Arizona, and by the time you retired after the 96 season, you had won three College World Series titles in 76, 80, and 86, and you finished with a record of 860 wins, 580 losses. An amazing run. Share with us some of your highlights of your Arizona coaching career.
Well, I'll begin by saying, John, it's the best place in the world to coach baseball at the University of Arizona. And when I was interested in the job, of course, I was Dick Siebert's assistant at that time, 1971. The job became open because Frank Sansett, who had been an outstanding coach here for 24 years, had announced his retirement and that he would coach one more season in 1972 and then was going to retire. So the job became open, and I went to Dick Siebert and I said, Dick, now mind you, I had been here in spring training with the Cleveland Indians in Tucson, Arizona, for 3 years with the Indians. And in up in Mesa, Arizona, with the Cubs for, 6 years. So I knew Tucson very, very well. And I said, Dick, I would like to apply for that job. I don't know if I'll get it, but would you help me? And he said, and I quote him now, and this I'll always be grateful. He said, Jerry, if you were to go there, I'd be losing my right arm. But I will help you because it's a great job. And he went on to say, if I got that job, if it were me, Dick Siebert, applying for that job, and I was selected, I wouldn't even wait to pick up my underwear. I would be on my way. Interesting way of saying, it's a great job, and I'll help you get it. And he did. He wrote me a terrific letter of recommendation and called the athletic director. Well, I was one of a number of candidates because of the luster of this job. The weather is outstanding. The facilities are great. The budget for baseball at that time, and still is, was outstanding. And so I got in the act, and they, I went down at my own expense for an interview, the first interview. And then they called me back later for a more serious interview with the selection committee. And it came down, finally, after months, that was 71, August of 71, my first interview. My second interview was December 1st, and they finally made their decision a week later. But it all came down to three candidates. Very interesting. I found this out later, John. They wanted to give the job and offered the job to Bobby Richardson, the great Yankee second baseman, all-star second baseman, who is now coaching at the University of South Carolina, very close to his home in Sumter, South Carolina. And he was doing very well. Well, he's a close personal friend. I got to know Bobby when I came in the American League, and he became a very close friend. And then he said no. He said, no, he was going to thank you for the offer, but I'm going to stay at South Carolina. I don't want to lose my family. And then they told him the two remaining candidates, and they asked for his judgment. And one was me, and the other was Steve Hamilton. Steve at that time, let's back up. Steve was a teammate of Bobby's for the Yankees.
Wow.
For about 5 years. He was a left-handed pitcher.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, he played pro basketball with the Minneapolis Lakers also.
Oh, is
Steve Hamilton, you can look it up.
Wow.
He was in the minor leagues pitching, and he also played with the Lakers for a couple of years. But by this time, he had pitched, I would say probably 7-8 years in major leagues, and was coaching baseball at Morehead State University, his alma mater, Morehead, Kentucky. And I don't know this for a fact, but Bobby Richardson probably said, well, you can flip a coin. Both of those guys are close personal friends. I can't tell you that one is better than the other. I think they're both outstanding candidates. But if you want to flip a coin, whoever comes up the winner of that coin flip, give them the job. Now, this is an assumption, but Steve Hamilton and I compared notes on this later. How in the world did you get it over me? How in the world did I get it over you? I was bewildered because Steve was an outstanding candidate and an outstanding gentleman. And he was by that time a good friend also because we had played together with the Indians. If you get the intrigue here, I'm sorry to be so windy about it. But anyway, they maybe flipped the coin and it came up Kindle, and they offered me the job. And I came on February 1st of 1972, moved my family down, in parenthetically, I was on my children's hit list for about 2 years for moving them out away from their aunts, uncles, grandmas, grandpas, and cousins down to the desert. But they got over it. And I was coach in waiting for the 1972 season. They hired me as the coach, but I would not take over until after the 72 season when Frank officially retired.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the benefit of recruiting and watching very carefully the players that were coming back in 1973 from the Wildcat squad. And that's how I got into the job. Most of my effort was in recruiting for the next season. And we had a pretty good team in 73. We had a terrific team in 74. The best I've ever coached was in 1974.
Really?
But we got bumped off in the playoffs, didn't make it to Omaha. And 75, USC, who went on to win the national championship, beat us in the regional final 1-0.
Ooh.
Or something like that. It was a one-run game. And so 76, it all came together, and we won our first national championship. Yes. That's how I got here.
I read somewhere that you had 209 players that signed big league contracts. You had 34 All-Americans, and 32 players, I think, went on to play in the big leagues.
Well, I didn't know those numbers exactly, but they sound about right. We had terrific players here, John. The players overcame the coaching and won a lot of ball games and national championships. But, you know, I have to say here, I had two, make that three, outstanding associates as my staff. Mark Johnson was here when I came in 1972 as freshman coach, and I kept him. And then I hired Jim Wing, who is a high school coach here, and the most beloved man to this day in all of Southern Arizona baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific high school coach, Legion coach, played at the University of Arizona as a backup catcher, but one of the best coaches I've ever been around, and he took over the pitching and catching for me, because I don't know anything about pitching. I tried to coach the pitchers the first year I was head coach here, and it was a disaster. And I gave that the next year over to Jim. I said, Jim, try to correct all the mistakes I made, and you be my pitching coach and catching coach. And he did that for the entire time I was coaching here, for 25 years, including that coach in waiting. And then Mark Johnson was our hitting coach and outfield coach. After the 76 season, he went on to Mississippi State as associate head coach and wound up at Texas A&M for 21 years. A great coach, and to this day, one of my closest personal friends. When he left, I hired Jerry Stitt, S-T-I-T-T, an All-American here at Arizona, played pro ball in the minor leagues and was high school coach at that time. And I brought him on the staff, and he became one of the great coaches I've ever witnessed as hitting coach. So without those three guys, I'm just a guy named Joe. I'm in the middle of the pack somewhere trying to make a living. I honestly say that I'm not. They deserve every bit as much credit as I deserve, or as I'm getting for our championship games, or championship teams, and for our record. Jerry Stitt, Jim Wing, Mark Johnson are three of the greatest coaches I've ever been around.
Wow, that's great. And you need that kind of help to really be successful as you were.
Oh, no question, because the expectations for me and for our team when I took over in 1972, the expectations were, don't just get to Omaha. You've got to win it.
Yeah.
We're going to hire a man who can give us confidence that we're going to win the national championship. That's exactly what they told me in the interview. And I gulped and I said, well, I think I can. And then when I got the job, I thought, what in the world am I doing? I had never had a head job. It's the only head coaching job I've ever had. But because I was fortunate enough to have these guys as my assistants, and I gave them a lot of responsibility, it came together.
Yeah.
And boy, do you ever need good men on your staff? I know that.
And, you know, you had to know what you were doing when you picked them, too. I mean, that's, you know, granted that they were there to really help you and did a great job, but, you know, you got to pick the right people, too.
Well, fortunately, I did make the right choices for those guys. And to this day, they're all very close to me personally, their wives, their families. It was one of the great blessings in my life, truly, to be the coach at Arizona and then to surround myself with these guys. And then the good players. My gosh, what did you say, 32 are made the major leagues?
Yep, yep. Yeah.
Well, how in the world did we recruit them? we didn't mess them up too badly. And,
So I'll really put you on the spot now. Who was the best player you ever coached?
Well, I've been asked that a lot, John. And I'll give you two names. And there are a host of guys that come right after them as outstanding players. But the two best that set aside in my mind are Dave Stegman, one of the first players I recruited when I came here from Lompoc, California. He's a center fielder. And he started for us for 4 years in center field. He could do it all. He could run, throw, hit in field, and hit with power. And he went on to play with the Tigers, the Yankees, in Toronto. He was up and down. You won't recognize his name as a great regular player.
Right.
But boy, could he play. And he was a straight-A student, by the way. And I don't say that just as an afterthought, because we had to have guys that were serious about school, because the eligibility rules are very strict. And if you put a lot of time and energy and invest a starting position in a player, and I'm speaking for all college coaches, and he doesn't do the job academically and comes up ineligible, it's a waste of time for him and for the coaching staff. So Dave Stegman stands out as one of the great student athletes I've ever had. And then the other is Terry Francona. Terry, I recruited, thanks to his mom and dad, Tito and Roberta. I played with Tito in Cleveland. He was the first baseman. Tito Francona, Terry's father. And we became good friends, and our families became good friends. And when Terry was like a sophomore in high school, I got a call from Tito back in New Brighton, Pennsylvania. He said, Jerry, I think my kid can play for you. And he said, he's a better hitter than I was. And Tito was a great hitter, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
He's a better hitter than I was. He's a better fielder than I was. And he runs faster than me. Well, I mean, that was music to my ears because Tito was pretty slow. But Tito was a great player. So he said, are you interested? And I said, I sure am. And I remember in spring training first being introduced to Terry Francona when he threw sand in my daughter's eyes.
Wow.
Playing in the playground where we were renting our bungalows for spring training. Just a little toddler. So anyway, I got busy and recruited Terry. And Tito and Bertie is dead now. Bertie, Roberta, his mother. They felt that I would watch out for Terry. And so they urged him to come here. He could have gone to any number of schools. He could have signed with the Cubs. The Cubs drafted him in the second or third round after his high school senior year at New Brighton, Pennsylvania, and offered him a very nice contract.
Mm.
But the family wanted him to go to school, and Terry wanted to go to school, too. And so he passed that up and came here to Arizona. He was an All-American for us. He played 3 years. He signed with Montreal after the 1980 championship team. He was on that team. And went on to be a really good big league outfielder. Now he's the best manager. But he could, he was a four-tool player, run, throw, hit, and field. He didn't have a lot of power, but he was a 400 hitter in college. And 1980, Terry Francona was selected the Golden Spikes winner, the best amateur player in the country, and went on to where he is right now, managing the Red Sox. So those two stand out, but then I've got to mention names like Ron Hassey, like Trevor Hoffman, like J.T. Snow. All of those guys distinguished themselves in the big leagues. But the two best that played here, I think, and it's a close race, John. I really shouldn't say one, two, three, four, five. It's not that. It's the collection.
mentioned
Franklin. Yeah.
You mentioned J.T. Snow, and he played football too, didn't he?
Not here, no. He played football in college, high school, over in Orange County, California. He was all-state in basketball, football, and baseball in high school.
Maybe I'm thinking of his dad.
Well, his dad, yes. He was an all-pro player and receiver. His first name was Jack Snow.
That must have been, huh?
Yeah, and then he went on to be a broadcaster for many years for the Rams. He played for the St. Louis Rams.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Franconas, and, you know, that's kind of rings a bell for me because, number one, I just watched, you know, Major League Baseball Channel last night, and they were interviewing Terry Francona, and he seemed... and he seems like a really, funny guy and interesting person.
Well, let me say this about Terry. He was this way as a player in college. He is absolutely genuine, John. There's no deceit. There's no pretension about Terry Francona. He is a loyal, upright guy that will tell it like it is, but he will tell you in loving and genuinely compassionate terms. That's why he's such a great manager. That's why he's been able to manage a team like the Red Sox with all kinds of egos.
Sure.
And, that kind of thing. And he can do it so well, and they love him. Everybody, there's not a man in baseball that says, or any place as far as I'm concerned, that says a bad word about Terry. He is absolutely genuine.
One of the things that I like to do, too, is I like to collect some baseball autographs now and then. They're primarily for Twins, but every once in a while I'll run across a card that piques my interest. And one of the cards that I had had a picture of Tito Francona and Terry Francona on it.
Oh, yeah.
Had the both of them.
Father and son.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. And so
that whole family's been a rich blessing to me for so many, many years, the Franconas.
Yeah. And I took that card and I sent it in the mail to both of them,
Yeah.
I can't remember which one I sent it to first, but I got his autograph, and then I sent it to the other one and got his autograph.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so that was pretty cool. I still have the card.
Yeah. Good for you, John.
Pretty cool.
John, I'm going to have to, this is parenthetical, but I have to conclude here in about 10 minutes.
Okay, and then we're just about done here, and I just had a couple more questions for you.
Okay.
What was more enjoyable for you, playing or coaching?
Oh, boy, it's a toss-up. I loved it all. Playing, there was always when I was in the big leagues, there was always the apprehension, because I was a utility guy for 6 years. I was a regular for 2 years, a utility man for six. So there was always the apprehension that somebody else could take my job. So that was kind of the angst I had as a player. And in coaching, you're responsible no longer for just your own performance. You're responsible for the performance for all of them, which is a huge responsibility also, together with your staff. But I can't say I enjoyed one more than the other.
Okay.
I am so deeply blessed, and by God, to have been doing this for so many years, what I always dreamed of doing. And to be a player and a coach. And here I am. I've been 14 years retired now, but I'm still hanging out at ballparks and love it.
That's great. The Fellowship of Christian Athletes has played a huge role in your life. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. My first contact with the FCA was when Bobby Richardson told me we were playing a series against the Yankees. What year would that have been? Probably 62, my first year in the American League. And he said, say, when you're in Kansas City, I'd have to be the first year. He said, when you're in Kansas City, I suggest you stop by the offices of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. There's some great men there, some godly men who want to reach out to high school and college athletes with the gospel. And Bobby is a devout Christian,
mm-hmm.
and he knew that I wanted to follow Christ in everything and do the right thing. So I did. I went into the office in Kansas City and just walked in, and they were having devotions, the staff of about four people. This is in the early days of FCA. when I became a coach at Minnesota and here in Arizona, I led the chapter each week of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes on the two campuses. And then I served as a committee man for a long, long time. I resigned that position just a short time ago. So FCA is very dear to my heart. It's a wonderful ministry.
Do you follow Major League Baseball today, Jay?
Oh, yes, very closely. I have a bunch of players, you know, either managing or coaching and playing. I'm 14 years out of the actual coaching. So I don't know if I have any left up there now that actually I coached here. But many that I've watched go through the program and are presently up in the big leagues now. So, yes, I watch it very closely.
So what does life find you doing nowadays, Jerry?
Well, I do a lot of volunteer work, John, in Christian ministries. I'm active in the Young Life, which is a Christian ministry to high school kids, and serve on the committee there and have over many, many years led clubs in high schools back in Minnesota. I am active in my own home church. I serve as an elder. And I do the broadcasting in the spring for college baseball. I've done that ever since I retired.
Sounds like
and
fun.
And the last 3 years, I've worked for the Big Ten. And am I ever pleased with that? I get to go back to those familiar venues. I've been to Seabird Field probably 3 times to broadcast on the Big Ten Network baseball series.
Hopefully the Gophers will get a new baseball.
Yes, I'm on the advisory committee. John Anderson asked me to serve to help raise money, and I'll do the best I can. He sure deserves a new ballpark.
Absolutely.
Then the other thing that has come in the last 4 or 5 years, I lecture, John, on cruise ships. My wife and I are able to cruise. Never thought a baseball coach would be able to do that. But I lecture on baseball. Take me out to the ballgame, the history of baseball.
You mentioned that's great.
So probably 2 times a year for the last 5 years, I guess it is, we've taken cruises, and I lecture on the charm and the legends and the problems and the intrigues, a lot of anecdotal stuff. But the history of baseball also is fascinating. I have a PowerPoint, thanks to my wife, Diane. Mm-hmm. By the way, you may know that my late wife, Georgia, died in 1987 of Lou Gehrig's disease. And a year later, I met a lovely, godly widow in Colorado Springs through mutual friends. And her husband had died of cancer about the same time that Georgia died. So a year later, we met, and we fell in love. And now Diane is the most... one of the great, huge blessings, perhaps the best. She and George are two of the greatest blessings I've had. Two godly wives. So, we've been married 22 years now. So there you are. That's my history.
That's pretty nice. We really appreciate you spending so much time with us today, Jerry.
I appreciate talking to you, John. I was looking forward to it, and I'm going to be on their website more often now to catch up with some of my old teammates and some of the great days of the Twins.
Well, I appreciate that. Is there any final thoughts you'd like to share with all your friends that are still back here in Minnesota?
Well, our door is open here. Come see us in Tucson, and